The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
In a perfect world, most Americans would march through life saving diligently, making good investment decisions, ultimately leading to a secure retirement. But we know we're far from that. A lot of times people make the wrong decisions. They don't save enough, or they do things that can sabotage their own retirement plan. Joining us on the program is author and columnist Jonathan Clements. And Jonathan, let's talk about the reality of today's retirement world, where many people will end up in retirement with a nest egg that they basically have, not the one they thought they would have. And I could just think of, you know, the events over the last 15 years, two bear markets, 0% interest rates. A lot of people ended up in retirement with less than they wanted.
And I think that's generally the case, Jim. People might have some number in their head for how much they want by the time they retire, but often, you know, they don't reach that number for one simple reason. They end up retiring before they planned. The Employee Benefit Research Institute does this annual retirement confidence survey, and what they found year after year is that people plan to retire at age 65, but in fact, on average, they end up retiring at age 62 or 3 years earlier. You know, given that, you know, most people are going to end up retiring with less than they expected to have, and we know from other sources that people simply don't have the huge nest eggs we'd like them to have by the time they retire. For instance, in that same retirement confidence survey put out by the Employee Benefit Research Institute, they found that those within 10 years of retirement age, half of those folks have $50,000 or less in retirement savings. These folks simply do not have enough money for a comfortable retirement.
You know, another mistake that we often see, you mentioned that people retire earlier instead of 65, they retire at age 62, and they also take their Social Security benefits at age 62, which is only 75% of their full benefit, versus some of the strategies that can allow that benefit to grow by 8% a year to age 70. So it's not just that they retire early, they make the same mistake when it comes to benefits.
You know, one of the things I say to people all the time, Jim, is that the problem with retirees is that they worry about dying young, whereas what they should really worry about is living longer than they ever imagined. And if your concern is living longer than you ever imagined and not outliving your retirement savings, a key strategy is for the main breadwinner in a couple or for a single individual to delay Social Security retirement benefits until at least their full Social Security retirement age of 66 or 67, and preferably through to age 70. And yet, as you indicated, almost half of all people claim benefits at age 62, thus accepting a permanently reduced benefit. And this is one of those times when the experts talk about this all the time. I mean, almost every knowledgeable financial planner that I talk to pushes their clients to try and delay Social Security until 66, preferably to age 70, and yet so many Americans rush to claim their benefits early and end up with a permanently reduced benefit.
You know, another issue that comes up, and this came out with William Bengen's study back in the 90s about the 4% withdrawal rate. You know, when he came out with that, Jonathan, it seemed reasonable given where the stock market was. It was going up double digits a year and where interest rates are. But we know that that rate may be too high.
Yeah, I mean, when Bengen came out with that study in the early 1990s, at the time it was an eye-opener for people, and they were saying a 4% withdrawal rate? I couldn't possibly afford to retire at that rate. Now, let's just take a step back and talk about what that 4% withdrawal rate means. It means that in the first year of retirement, you can withdraw $4,000 from your portfolio for every $100,000 you have saved. In subsequent years, you would step up the dollar amount you withdraw from your portfolio with inflation. So if you retire with, say, $500,000, that would be a substantial sum to most people. In your first year of retirement, you would have a total withdrawal, including dividends and interest, of $20,000. A lot of people look at that number and say, it's way too little. And yet, in today's environment where we have low bond yields and rich stock market valuations, even a 4% withdrawal rate has been called into question. And yet we also know that, you know, if you tell people you have to withdraw less than 4%, they simply can't afford to retire. They simply don't have enough money. So most people need to find some strategy that's going to allow them to withdraw more than 4%. One way to get around that is to use your savings to pay for the early retirement years while delaying Social Security so you get that larger monthly check. Another alternative, and a deeply unpopular alternative, is to look into purchasing some sort of income annuity. But the statistics tell us that those plain vanilla immediate fixed annuities, it's the one annuity product that I'm actually a fan of, hardly any of those get bought every year.
You know, that's amazing, because at one time, if you looked at corporate life, when people had defined benefit pension plans, essentially, Jonathan, a defined benefit pension plan was a immediate annuity. A company would go to an insurance company and say, here's an employee, here's the amount of money that we've saved for him or her, given their life expectancy, what would you give them in a monthly check? So why do you think they're seldom used? Because they're great forms of steady income. I know Professor Wade Fow at American College has done quite a bit of work on this and found this is very successful when used with dividend-paying stocks.
It's one of those great ironies, Jim. You know, people will work for 30 years at a job they hate in order to become vested in a traditional pension plan where they get that check every month for the rest of their life. And yet, people won't actually take their own dollars and buy a comparable stream of income in the form of an immediate fixed annuity when they retire. It's absolutely bizarre. I think it has to do with this great fear that we're going to buy the annuity and then we're going to keel over and die tomorrow, and we will have given this huge sum to the annuity company and got nothing back in return. And yet, when you think about an immediate fixed annuity, what you should think of it as is as in a form of insurance. And we buy insurance all the time and pay money, and you know, we end up making bad bets. I mean, people buy homeowners insurance and you know, end up getting nothing back for the premiums paid. People buy life insurance and they never collect on the policy because they don't die. Most of the time, we're pretty happy not to get anything back from these policies. With an immediate fixed annuity, it's the same thing. It's risk pooling, but there is a difference. And in this case, you want to collect on it, and the way you collect on it is living as long as possible. And the great fear is that you won't live long enough in order to make it worthwhile.
But you know, there are a lot of steps that you can do with those kind of annuities where you can get like a 10-year certain. So if something happens to you on the medical side, you would make sure that the estate was paid a certain amount of money. I want to move on to things when it comes to retirement. We all know that when you get ready to retire, you're probably going to be a lot more conservative than, let's say, when you were getting a paycheck during your working career. But a lot of retirees you talk about are still coupon clippers at heart. Explain what you mean by that.
When I talk about coupon clippers, I'm not talking about the grocery store variety. What I'm talking about is in the old days, when you bought a stock or you bought a bond, those stock certificates or bond certificates would come with a series of coupons on them, and you would literally clip them from the bottom, go to the bank, and you would get your dividend or your interest payment. People love getting investment income. They love this idea that, you know, I can put my money into this particular instrument and every month or every quarter I'm going to get a regular income. And the reason that people like this is because it goes back to that golden rule that we all heard growing up, which is that, you know, it's okay to spend your income, but you should never, ever touch your capital. You shouldn't touch your principal. And so if you buy these high-yielding investments and you're able to cover your retirement expenses with them, you're able to meet that rule. You're able to keep your principal intact and get your retirement income. The problem is, in today's low-yield world, if you try to cover your retirement expenses by going out and buying high-yield investments that are going to generate enough income to cover your retirement expenses, you're going to end up taking an alarming amount of risk. You're going to find yourself putting a lot of money into high-yielding preferred stocks, into high-yielding junk bonds, into master limited partnerships. And while some investment in these areas is okay, if it's your entire portfolio, what you can find is you're taking a lot of credit risk. And if there's a downturn in the economy or a downturn in particular sectors or interest rates go sharply higher, you could lose substantial amounts of principal. So this focus on yield can end up distracting people from the risks they're taking, and they can end up making a big mistake.
You know, this is one thing that we're taught this. If you're a financial planner, you're an investment advisor, you're talked about the soundness of a diversified portfolio. But one thing that I've seen, Jonathan, and this relates back to your coupon clippers, that since the financial crisis of 2007 to 2009, investors have gravitated towards one type of investment as a solution. So as interest rates came down, they went all into bond funds. Or, you know, during the hyper period of gold, when it went up to 19, you saw a lot of people put large amounts in the gold market at the peak. Why do you think people do that today? It's almost like they're looking for a simple solution where basically instead of, you know, a diversified portfolio, some bonds, maybe an income annuity, some stocks, they go all in one particular type of investment.
I think this goes to investor psychology, Jim. And in particular, we are most comfortable owning investments that are popular. You know, if your neighbor is buying gold stocks, if your brother-in-law is buying gold stocks, suddenly gold stocks seem like a safe investment and they become a comfortable thing to own. The problem is when something becomes extremely popular, then the odds are it's also overpriced. If everybody's buying it, the odds are that the investment in question is trading at more than its fair value, and you're going to end up suffering because, you know, once something becomes overvalued, eventually the price is paid. Everybody should have a diversified portfolio. And what that means is that in any given year, some part of your portfolio is not going to be doing well. If you have a portfolio where everything is doing well in any particular year, the odds are you aren't well diversified. And if you're not careful, you're going to end up paying a heavy price for the concentrated portfolio that you own.
I want to move on to, you talk about the proper steps to take when preparing a financial plan. And I guess, you know, it's amazing. I think I read the statistic, Jonathan, you probably know more about this than I do, that most or 70% of Americans don't have a retirement plan. And you would think of something as important as that. And I wonder if that had a lot to do with back in the old days, let's say in our parents' days, you know, mom and dad or dad went to work for a company, spent 30 years, he got his Timex watch and he got a pension and Social Security. So between his pension, which was a defined benefit, and Social Security, he pretty much ended up going into retirement with an income close to what he earned during his working career. But why do you think more people don't do planning today when we know that you need to have some kind of plan? And especially as we've seen in the financial crisis, where a lot of people were laid off, they lost their jobs, ended up heading into retirement at a much earlier age than they would have thought of, not by their own choosing.
Well, if you go back over the past 35 years, what we've seen is that Americans have been asked to take on more and more financial responsibility. We've seen the demise of these traditional company pensions. We've seen an increase in the Social Security retirement age. And instead, you know, people have been pushed to save for their own retirement by saving in 401k plans, 403b plans, IRAs, and their regular taxable account. So people have more financial responsibility than ever before. And even as that has happened, the financial world has become more complex. The number of mutual funds available has skyrocketed. The variety of asset classes that people can invest in has soared. In many ways, for the sophisticated investor, this is a wonderful world. There are so many different investment options out there. But for the ordinary investor who doesn't devote their days to this stuff, it's more perplexing than ever. So the need to have a financial plan is greater than ever before, and yet I think people are daunted by the complexity. The good news is, if you want to have a financial plan, today the financial advice business is far friendlier to investors than it was 30 or 40 years ago. You know, we don't have armies of commissioned salesmen, you know, preying on investors today. There are a lot of fee-only financial planners. There are some great online robo-advisors for the do-it-yourselfer. There are some great online tools that allow people to create their own financial plan. So if you're smart and if you're diligent, you can either help yourself or find somebody to help you, and you should be able to do it without threatening your financial future.
You know, the other thing, too, that we have today that we didn't have, let's say, 25, 30 years ago when I got in the industry, there's so many different investment products that are out there today. There's immediate annuities. I mean, just look at the plethora of ETFs today. So it's much easier to invest. But one of the things that I've seen is that, and you see this even with younger people, that, you know, I was taught when I came in the industry, the idea of dollar cost averaging, which is what most people do when they have a 401k plan and they're putting money out of their paycheck every single month. But a lot of people get frightened because of the stock market. Maybe the stock market goes through a 10% correction and they'll go to cash, when the whole idea of dollar cost averaging, that's exactly what you want to happen, is when, you know, the stock market goes down, you're taking money out of your paycheck into your 401k, you are buying more shares that month with that money when the market's down. And really what it counts, Jonathan, by the time you get to retirement, is how many shares you're going to own.
You're absolutely right, Jim. I teach a college course on personal finance. And, you know, I was talking to my students about this recently. I was drawing a chart of the market, and I said, you know, you're going to leave college, you're going to be 23, you're going to be regularly investing in the financial markets for the next four decades. Now, what sort of return pattern would you want? Do you want to have the market rising at a steady rate every year? Do you want to see great returns early on and then sort of flatten out? Or would you like to have lousy returns and then see the market, you know, jump in value as approach for retirement? And the kids, you know, like the idea of earning a steady amount, or they like the idea of putting some money in the market and immediately seeing it go up. But if you're saving regularly for retirement, if you're a young person, you should get down on your hands and knees and pray for a spectacular stock market collapse. Because that, if you're regularly saving, if you're regularly dollar cost averaging into the stock market, that will allow you to buy more shares, to allow you to buy shares at cheaper prices, and you'll be in much better shape by the time you reach retirement. For retirees, it's a completely different story. For them, a market collapse would be a terrible thing, which is why they shouldn't be too heavily invested in the stock market. But for people who are young, who are regularly saving for retirement, a lousy stock market is a wonderful thing.
So in an ideal world, when you're planning for retirement, as you mentioned earlier, people need to plan for living longer. That's one of the things that we've seen. I think when Social Security first came out, Jonathan, the average male was expected to live to age 65. Today, men are living to 85, some in their 90s. So people are living longer. I think the statistic was something like 25 years spent in retirement between a husband and wife. So ideally, if you were to start out in life, let's say you were to take those college students that you're teaching and they were to start out their working career in an ideal world, what would you suggest that they do?
One of the things that I encourage my kids to think about as they look at their finances is to take their so-called human capital, their income earning ability, and put it at the center of their financial plan. Because once you start to think about that regular income that you're going to earn over the next 40 years, it could really guide the rest of your financial behavior. And in particular, there are four things that having that regular stream of income over 40 years allows you to do. I mean, first of all, you need to take part of every paycheck and put it aside for retirement. You need to build up a large pile of financial capital for the day when you no longer have your human capital. Second, when you think about your paycheck, you should think about it as being comparable to collecting interest from a bond. Your human capital is like a massive position in bonds, and that frees you up early in your working life to invest heavily in stocks. Once you get close to retirement and the end of the income from your human capital, from that personal bond that you have to start to change your portfolio and build up the bonds within your investment portfolio to compensate for the disappearance of your paycheck. Third, you need to protect your human capital, and that means having the right insurance. You need to have health insurance. You ought to have disability insurance. If you have a family that depends on you financially, you need life insurance. And finally, when you think about your financial life, you should think about how your human capital impacts the debts that you take on. Entirely prudent to take on debt early in your working career, because you know you're going to have those 40 years of paychecks in order to repay those debts. So taking on student loans, taking out a mortgage in your 20s, that's fine. But what you want to do is make sure that by the time you retire, those debts are paid off, because you're no longer going to have a regular paycheck to service those debts.
You know, the thing that amazes me, and maybe there's some hope here, you're talking about a college course that you teach on finances, because, you know, we have a plethora of universities around this country, from junior colleges to Ivy League schools to state-run schools. We teach people basically how to go out and earn a living, but we don't teach them how to manage their finances as a result of earning a living. And it should be almost incorporated in every single college curriculum that, look, you're going to go out in your working career. If you're college educated, you're more likely to earn more money than somebody that's non-college educated. But how to manage that money when you do, so that you don't get yourself overburdened in debt. You make the right investment choices early on in your career, and you do things like putting money aside. It's amazing. We've done a number of studies, and if you were to start out, let's say you wanted to retire at age 65, and you began your working career at 25, so you're going to work for 40 years, how very little you need to put aside on a monthly basis starting out early to, let's say, have $1 million by the time you get to age 65. It's amazing. The earlier you start, the longer the period that you compound. But a lot of people just don't grasp that concept, or it's not taught.
You're absolutely right. And for the college kids who get out into the work world and do start to save regularly right away, they can make the rest of their lives easier. If you start saving at 22 or 23 when you get out of the workforce, within 10 or 15 years, you can get to the point where, you know, your portfolio is of a substantial size, and, you know, you're getting as much help from the financial markets each year as the raw dollars that you're putting away. And with that increasing financial freedom comes less financial stress. It comes the lowering of the amount you pay in financial costs, because you no longer can carry a credit card balance. You know, you can move into a lower cost mutual funds that have higher minimum balances. You can avoid those silly overdraft fees because you don't have enough in your checking account. As you build up your wealth, your financial costs go down, your financial stress goes down, and maybe most important, you buy yourself some financial freedom. A lot of people who start work at 22 or 23 will get to their 40s and realize that they want to do something different with their lives, or perhaps they'll be compelled to do something different with their lives. Global competition, technology changes may force them out of the job that they have. If you've done a good job of saving and investing over those first 20 years in the workforce, you will have the financial flexibility to go off and do something else. Maybe swap to a career that's less lucrative, but which you personally will find more fulfilling. By starting to save and invest early in your working career, you can make the rest of your life easier.
So, as you've been lecturing about financial planning issues, teaching a college course, if you were to boil it down to a few simple facts or pieces of advice that you would give somebody starting out, or maybe even somebody heading into retirement, Jonathan, what would that be?
The number one attribute that almost every successful person I know who's got a good grasp on their personal finances, the number one attribute that they have is that they are good savers. If you can't manage to delay gratification, if you can't manage to control your spending, your entire life is going to be a struggle. You know, it's the classic millionaire next door. You know, these are the folks who live beneath their means, you know, don't feel compelled to buy the new car every 3 years, don't feel compelled to own the biggest house on the block. They live well beneath their means, they save diligently every month, and those are the folks who reach a state of financial serenity and for whom their money does not make them anxious. So good savings habits, that is the bedrock on which everything else is built.
You know, you bring up an interesting point. Every once in a while, you'll read these stories in the Wall Street Journal. There was one last year I can remember distinctively. This gentleman started out working in a gas station that his brother owned. Later on, he became a janitor at a JCPenney store, but he fell in love with the stock market, learned about it, went to the library, read Value Line, started investing in blue chip stocks. And, you know, at the age of 90-something, when he passed away, he had over a $9 million portfolio. It's just absolutely amazing. Now, here was a guy that started out as a gas station attendant and a janitor at a JCPenney's with $9 million.
I remember that story. It was about a guy in Brattleboro, Vermont called Ronald Reed. And when you read the story, you know, what you need to realize is that there were two keys to his investment success. One, he was frugal, which allowed him to save. And two, he made a long-term commitment to the stock market. You know, frugality is obvious. You need to save. But making that long-term commitment to the stock market, I mean, that takes emotional tenacity. You know, every year, there's another reason not to own stocks. You know, there's another financial crisis. There's another company that gets into financial trouble. There's political turmoil. There's war in the Middle East. Whatever it is, there's a reason to get out of the market. And yet, those who stick around and make a long-term commitment to the stock market, you know, over long periods, have earned impressive gains, and those impressive gains, combined with good savings habits, can lead to startling wealth.
Well, I guess maybe the best example of that is a gentleman by the name of Warren Buffett, who has been a long-term investor, built probably the most successful insurance company in history with Berkshire Hathaway, but employ those same things. I mean, Warren drives a used Cadillac and lives in the same house that he grew up 30 years ago and is, what, the second or third richest man in the world?
Let's give Warren Buffett his credit. He's a little better at picking stocks than you and me.
Yeah, that's true. A lot more investment acumen. But once again, taking that investment acumen aside, it was a long-term commitment to the stock market, understanding what he invested, and just, you know, he's a good businessman more than just anything else. But you hear all these stories, like the gentleman that was a janitor, and it once again demonstrates that, you know, these were people that didn't have extraordinary capabilities, average people that had a long-term commitment, frugal, and were good savers. Well, listen, Jonathan, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, how could they do so?
My website is jonathanclements.com, and I blog on there fairly regularly. And if people want to learn about how I think about money, they may want to pick up my Jonathan Clements Money Guide 2016. That's my annual updated financial guide. And the easiest place to get it is Amazon.
Well, listen, Jonathan, as always, thanks for joining us on the program. You have yourself a good day, sir.
All right. Thank you.
You know, Jim, what you were discussing here with your guest, with Jonathan Clements, what's really interesting is we have a situation, it's not just in the United States, by the way, it's also existing in Europe, where there is tremendous disaffection with government. They believe that the governments, and we do here, governments are running out of control, that they are consuming incredible amounts of resources, that their politicians are frequently lying to them. Let's just call it what it is. And at the very same time, governments are having to go into a status of reneging on the things they have promised. Now, what's been interesting is this little rollback that we've been talking about in Social Security, which came up at the end of last year. It has barely scratched any surface. Have you noticed that in all of the presidential debates that I've watched so far? People are totally unaware of what just went down. But it's the beginning of what you and I are calling the great reneging.
Unfortunately, John, the next president, when he assumes office, either he or she, is going to be saddled with $20 trillion, which is going to place a lot of restrictions and abilities. I mean, I have to laugh sometimes why the media isn't picking up on free college, free medical care. I mean, where's the money going to come from when 90% of the budget is spoken for? The other 10% is spent running government. So there isn't much wiggle room here, which is why I think you just saw a new proposal to limit what kind of drugs doctors prescribe, incentivizing doctors to use generics instead of state-of-the-art drugs. And John, I think that's just going to be part of the landscape going forward, because basically the government's running out of money. Well, speaking of running out, we are running out of time. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.